Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the October NJEDA board meeting. At this time, all phone participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised, today's meeting is being recorded. When the chairman opens the public comment portion of the meeting, members of the public attending by phone will be advised to press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad to be placed in a queue to speak to the provide comments. Excuse me. You will be asked to provide your name and any organization with which you are affiliated. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star, then 0. I would now like to turn the conference over to Chairman Terry O'Toole. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Operator. Jim, do you want to read the public notice meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. In accordance with the Open Public Meeting Act, notice this meeting has been sent to the Star Ledger and the Times of Trend at least 48 hours prior to this meeting, and a meeting notice has been posted on the Secretary of State's bulletin board at the Department of State. Thank you, Kim. Mary, do you want to do the roll call, please?
Chairman Terry O'Toole.
Present.
Vice Chairman Charles Barlow. Cynthia Bauer.
He's calling in late for him.
Here. Aisha Glover. Present live and in person, North. Marcia Marley.
Present here.
Jewel Antoine Johnson.
Present.
Robert Chimko.
I'm here.
Macio Medina Ferrara.
Here.
Silva Lagia.
Here.
Fred Dumont. Aaron Cruz from the executive branch.
Here by phone. Good morning.
Okay. Commissioner Justin Zimmerman from Banking.
Here.
Labor Commissioner Robert Angelo.
Here.
State Treasurer Elizabeth Moyo.
Here.
Okay. Elizabeth Dragon for Commissioner Sean Lasserette of DEP.
Here.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we have a call.
Thank you, Nurse. There are two sets of meeting minutes for approval today. Before you are the minutes from the September 12th NJEDA board meeting for review and approval. I kindly request that board members state their name for the record when making a motion or second. Thank you. Could I hear a motion to approve the September 12th board meeting minutes?
So moved, Angela.
Thank you. A second?
Second, Jenny Bauer.
Thank you. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, all in favor, vote by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Secondly, also from September 12, 2023, the executive session meeting minutes. Could I hear a motion to approve?
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Thank you. Second?
Second, Marcia.
Thank you. Any discussion? Hearing none, can I hear a vote? All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the minutes are approved. We're going to move to the chairman's remarks. And I think today you're going to find the agenda is a little different from our typical cadence. We'll probably spend more time up front than normal because we have a lot to discuss today. So first of all, a welcome to our NJEDA October board meeting. It's great to be here in the Authority of Newark office, especially for those of us from North Jersey. We held our June meeting at the NJEDA's Fort Monmouth office, and now that we're back to a full schedule of in-person meetings, we will continue to periodically meet outside of Trent headquarters so that the board can see our reach throughout the state of New Jersey. We began our September board meeting with a moment of silence in memory of September 11th. Sadly, we now meet in October, days after the massacre in Israel. I want to share the sentiments of support and condolences expressed to Israel by President Biden and Governor Murphy. I can't begin to imagine the suffering and grief. Unfortunately, the days ahead are likely to bring so much more pain. And sometimes I find it hard to believe that in the 21st century, we see so much war. Let's all remember those lost, those in harm's way, and pray for peace. September marks the six-month anniversary of my appointment as the chairman of the NJEDA Board of Directors. I've thoroughly enjoyed getting to know the board members and the staff of the NJEDA. and remain impressed with the talent, integrity, and dedication to the NJEDA's efforts in support of Governor Murphy's vision for a stronger and fairer economy in New Jersey. Being an NJEDA board member is a big responsibility, and we ask a lot of our public board members, all of whom are volunteers. As you know, our monthly meeting schedule is robust, and nearly every agenda is packed. Despite these demands, and in most cases on top of their full-time careers elsewhere, I found the NJEDA's board members to be enthusiastic and passionate about the work of the authority. I've also enjoyed getting to know Tim, incredibly supportive as I learned about the NJEDA. The six-month milestone seemed like a good opportunity to reflect on my experience so far as board chair and the comments I heard from our public board members, almost all of whom I've met individually. I tried to summarize those thoughts in a memo I sent to Tim in mid-December, a copy of which is included in your board package today. Tim's response is also included in your board package and outlines many of the steps that have been taken so far to make this board as effective as possible and to ensure, enable us to continue to attract the type of high-performing board members that we've historically had. Many of these changes reflect recommendations included in the board governance review presented by Funston Advisory Services in October 2020, known as the Funston Report. So Tim and I in our memos focused on four key themes. I actually have a PowerPoint slide
right behind you
for my remarks. The four themes are what I call the board experience, the role of committees, the breadth of programs and monitoring, and finally evaluating performance and strategic vision. So following are a few quick updates on progress to date in each of these categories and plans for additional enhancements. So first on the board experience. Progress in this area includes implementation of an enhanced delegation policy, which simplified and clarified how and when authority could be delegated with the goal of reducing the number of monthly agenda items that the board reviews. The authority has already approved nearly 50 new delegations of authority. Also, we're working on provision of board materials a week in advance of meetings whenever possible. When additions or revisions are necessary, staff summarizes them for the convenience of members. Additional steps under consideration are staff review of further opportunities for program-level delegation of authority with the goal of advancing a package of incremental delegations by year-end. And we're exploring the potential to use consent agendas as some other New Jersey public instrumentalities do, although this does prevent some logistical and practical hurdles. We plan to report back on this effort to the Policy Committee in November. Second is the role of committees. In the last several months, we've attempted to bring some of the best practices from full board meetings to committee meetings, particularly the use of summary slides for all items so we can remember where the various items fit within our programs. We've also worked to expand and deepen the report to the full board from committee chairs, including a description of each item discussed, key discussion topics, and whether any items did not advance from committee to the full board. We'll continue to work to improve the quality and depth of these reports. The next step includes that beginning with the November board cycle, staff will include a detailed written report from each committee with item-by-item notes in the packets of memos and resolutions distributed to the full board. In addition to enhancing information sharing, this also will help, hopefully, us implement a consent agenda. The third bullet point is the breadth of programs and monitoring. We have a lot of programs. Beginning with the September 2023 board meeting, we initiated an expansion of Tim's CEO report to include one or more detailed program review and update discussions. We'll aim to have each major program reviewed once a year and pilot programs twice a year for when changes are contemplated. Additional steps, some of which are already happening, include developing a comprehensive board dashboard to provide key information in an easily digestible format. Board members saw a copy of that provided last night. And we are also, we created what Tim will walk you through in a few minutes as a particularly New Jersey item called the Diner Menu, which is a list of all of our various programs in a very a readable format so we can all have those at our fingertips. We're also considering creating a new position whose sole responsibility will be ensuring robust and regular program level reporting to the board. And the final category is performance and strategic vision.
Since 2018, the NJEDA's efforts have been guided by Governor Murphy's signature economic development plan, the State of Innovation, Building a Stronger and Fairer Economy in New Jersey, as well as numerous legislative initiatives, particularly the Economic Recovery Act of 2020, signed into law in January of 2021, and executive initiatives, particularly on COVID relief and recovery efforts. As we approach the second half of Governor Murphy's second term, it's an opportune time to step back and evaluate both the performance of the NJEDA's programs as well as the performance of the New Jersey economy. And board members, again, last night received two reports prepared by McKinsey on those two topics, and Tim's going to give a brief summary today. There's a lot to digest there, and we won't have time to go through it all today. It's also time to craft an NJEDA strategic plan for the next 3 years. To ensure the board members have an opportunity to shape the strategic planning process, we anticipate scheduling a full-day board retreat in late 2023. I think board members all received an email within the last week with our suggested date. We'll assess attendance and hopefully proceed, and if it doesn't work for board members, we'll find a new date. As part of the implementation of the updated strategic plan, we will plan on semi-annual reviews with the board, with the policy committee of the board, on key progress milestones, as well as a regularly scheduled annual board retreat for broader step back on progress against the plan. I appreciate Tim's partnership in addressing these enhancements to our board and overall governance process. Would also like to take this opportunity to express our deepest gratitude to our hardworking and dedicated board members. This is truly a top-notch, highly respected team. I thank each and every one of you for your support during my early months as chair. I appreciate the opportunity to provide these updates today, and I hope you find them responsive to your comments to me. Now I'm going to turn the meeting over to Tim for his CEO report.
Great. Good morning. Thank you, Chairman. Let me start by echoing word for word your sentiment, the governor's sentiment, the president's sentiments about the horrific situation in Israel and standing in solidarity with Israel and praying for peace. So let me just echo those sentiments as well. First of all, happy 6 months. Time flies when we're having fun. Great. It's appreciate everything you've laid out in the memo here. We got a couple things here in my CEO report. As the chairman mentioned, using this as the sort of vehicle to provide a little bit more granularity on some things. I don't want to make sit here all morning as part of my report, which we'll get to Evan-wise in a moment. But you have included a written report here on a number of things that have happened. We had the governor's conference on housing and economic development down in Atlantic City. It's a great conference. It was not the same without the late great Sheila Oliver, who led that event and was one of her pride and joys as LG and DCA commissioner. But it was a great event all the same. And that was a nice event. We were together with a group of legislators and business leaders in Bloomfield last week. Was that last week? I'm losing track of time. I think it was last week. It was before to announce the cannabis grants under the first phase of that program. So 48 cannabis grants to startup companies, small businesses that are making their way ahead in cannabis. We had a great business qualify the Tech and Innovation Conference that happens annually, and our staff had really good turnout. Really good panel presentations and presenting there. So we have continued to be just active all across the board. Speaking of innovation, in a few minutes, once I finish yammering on, we will have for your consideration the first approval under the Evergreen Program, which was one of the signature items that came out of the Governor's Economic Development Plan, which turned 5 years old on October 1st. And we'll have our first approval, hopefully, or certainly the first proposal for your consideration will happen in a few minutes. Signature moment in the governor's vision for a stronger and fairer economy overall and for a more robust innovation and startup ecosystem. A couple things before I hand it to Evan, I'll introduce properly at the moment. I just wanted to note, maybe you might have seen some press reports, we've had two folks join us, both in senior advisor roles in the last couple weeks. One is John Kennedy, who previously was the president and CEO of the New Jersey Manufacturing Extension Program, and a longtime partner of ours. We now have Jonathan Kennedy from the Windport, who is doing a rare board meeting where he's not presenting something on the Windport. We have Jonathan Kennedy and John Kennedy, and of course, former President Kennedy. I'm trying to keep them all straight. They will get Jonathan and John already get each other's emails. It's very exciting. We're both managing good cheer so far. And then Mary Maples, who's in the back, joined us Tuesday. It was her first day as a senior advisor, formerly CEO of University Hospital, formerly general counsel. There's fancy words for your title when you were the lawyer there. General counsel and corporate secretary or something like that of University Hospital and previously ran the Patrick Authorities Unit. Previously was at this table in Trenton as the board member, so knows us quite well. And thrilled to have her on board. And again, there's lots of ways you can look at the barometer of the health of an organization and where you're going, but when talented people want to be a part of it, that's a really good sign. So Mary, John, lots of other folks are great symbols of that or signs of that. When we were in Fort Monmouth, as the chairman mentioned, Kara and Sarah were good enough to do a bus tour of everything going on in Fort Monmouth and where all the Netflix stuff is going to go and all that exciting thing, all that exciting stuff. We did not think we had time, nor could you do justice to the entire city of Newark in any kind of tour. So we've asked Evan White to join us and be the human embodied tour of Newark. Newark, good luck. Best of luck to you. Evan is not only a dear friend and a former colleague and partner from his time in the governor's office, but he's the president and CEO of the Newark Alliance, which is a great organization. It's so great that his former president and CEO is on our board. And she was working there. She had a guy named George Santos working for her, who I was good enough to deal, and I think we're almost forgiven right now. It's only been a couple of years. But Evan is an incredibly great champion, not just for Newark, but the entire state. A lot of the work that we did together, I'll talk about in a few minutes, and the results of how we've done. That Evan is one of the smartest, most talented, energetic people anywhere in the world, and particularly working here in Newark. So Evan's going to give us a few minutes on the Alliance, what's going on in Newark, good things, things we've got to work on, that kind of stuff. So without further ado, Evan Weiss. Very nice. You can take the podium if you wish. Or you can just holler.
Hi, that's fine. Good to see everybody. Thank you for having me here today as a guest. It's interesting to be on this side of things, having had the genuine pleasure to work with so many of you at the governor's office or even when I was consultant in the North Alliance when the issue was listed out there. I'm sure I can do justice to Newark. Obviously, your tour would have gone great. So I'd like to start off with one basic fact about Newark, which is that it's bigger than Pittsburgh in terms of population. When you tell people that nationally or locally, that can't be right. But it's true. Newark is a major American city. It has been a major American city for basically all of American history. It's the third oldest city in the United States. It was settled in 1666. So we're going to jump ahead a little bit.
And then the year after.
So what's interesting to me about the founding story is that it was settled by Puritans from Connecticut, who thought the Puritan life in Connecticut was not radical and hardcore. So they founded Newark, which became a hotbed of Puritan sentiment and radicalism, honestly, which is a very different contrast. And I think that's kind of business that very founding, that's one of the few connections back to like the Robert Treat era, that spirit of radicalism, pushing the edge, getting somewhere first, which is, I think, most famously encapsulated by Mayor Kenneth Gibson, who said, wherever American cities are going, Newark will get there first. And in many ways, I think you see that locally, within the state of New Jersey, the similar sentiment. So, as was mentioned, I run the Newark Alliance. Newark Alliance-like entities can be found in Camden, what used to be Cooper's Ferry Partnership, now Camden Community Partnership, in Trenton, Greater Trenton, is another example. We are a collection of the corporations, hospitals, universities, the big developers, the arts institutions. They're all members of our organizations, all committed to equitable economic growth in the city. So very similar mission to the EDA, but just in a much more concentrated way. So before I worked for Governor Murphy, I worked in a lot of cities that you might call like within the Rust Belt, places that have had similar struggles to Newark, but are in a very different state today. Whereas the key problem is different. It's not that Newark had a giant steel mill or hard plant that then moved out. People did move out from an economic perspective, but look around, look over the city. The economic activity in the city has not gone in any meaningful way. It is very easily shifted through when we deindustrialized to when jobs changed into being more of the service and innovation sector. They've remained in Newark, but they've remained in these towers. And I didn't want you to go through a meeting without talking about the wind port, so we'll talk about the wind port. Because there's this issue there that reminds me so much of this, where the wind port's literally being built next to a nuclear power plant, one of the biggest generators of electricity in the United States. You need electricity for the wind port, but you couldn't just, like, tap that nuclear power plant and get electricity to the wind port. It's a very convoluted method. It's Atlantic Spectrum hopefully Jonathan Kennedy doesn't know this, but I remember this was
at a price.
Yeah. So it's like, it's a weird metaphor, but it's one that stuck with me, where we have that nuclear power plant, that incredible amount of innovation in the economy going on here, whether it's Audible, whether it's Prudential, whether it's EngineTech, it's all here. It's about connecting it to the residents of the city and bringing that economic opportunity that we generate in Newark and making it fair, making it for the residents, which, you know, one of the projects Aisha worked on, and her predecessor as well, was this idea of we have one of the worst rates of residents in the city who then have jobs in the city, particularly the highest paying jobs in any part of the country. And that basic imbalance is exactly, I think, what we're trying to solve. And so I'll talk about one thing the Alliance is doing, thanks to EPA, which I think is a great example of, you know, the kind of work that we're trying to do. Was we were a successful applicant to one of the really cool new programs, one of the many that the chair, you know, talked about earlier, the Food Deserts Planning Grant Program, where the Alliance partnered with Rutgers University, one of our members, for the specific site on Halsey Street, which is one of our main focus areas, this commercial corridor in Newark, along with Clinton Hill Community Action, which is one of the neighborhood CDCs in Newark, to try to create a food hub in downtown Newark, which would be an entrepreneurship center, wholesale food hub, a source for food for people in need, and then having this kind of hub and spoke relationship with a neighborhood CDC here. And so, well, I'll pause to describe a little more of that, but just to say, I bring that up because that's the other main division in Newark, the economic activity with the residents and the downtown with what people here call the wards, different neighborhoods in Newark. There's 5 wards, and there's this very strong feeling that what happens in downtown is not for them. It's separate. There's all this stuff going on, there's activity, but that's someone else, it's not for me. And so that, I think, in a nutshell, in addition to the overall economic work we're trying to do, is how do we bring the neighborhoods downtown? How do we bring downtown into the neighborhoods and all the opportunities of each? And so every ward, every neighborhood is incredibly diverse. To go back to national cities, like, we are now 200,000 people smaller than Detroit, but Detroit is like 10 times physically as big as Newark. We have packed so much into this city. Every neighborhood has a very distinct character, incredible food to try in every neighborhood. It's very unusual where we're 26 square miles, 5 of which or so is the port, that the amount of stuff we have here with 300,000 people is incredible. So that food hub work we're doing with Clinton Hill that you've been able to help us with is an example of that. Like, how do we connect the food culture of the South Ward with downtown, getting businesses to the South Ward that then start selling to customers here? You go out for lunch, you know, or after your board meeting and catering, like, we want to make those connections stronger. So the return to office is sort of an obvious point of kind of one of the top line struggles that we're having here, where that wealth, that availability that happened when there was more commuting, you know, was definitely not fake. But it's been interesting to watch us compared to San Francisco, compared to New York City, where there hasn't been that much change really in downtown Newark since COVID. There's been some. I don't want to minimize the effect, but what is kind of the central problem that I hope we can work on together is, again, like, people came to Gateway, they didn't leave Gateway during the day. People worked at Prudential, they didn't leave Prudential during the day. I think some of your early programs, some of the stuff that implemented helped the recruits, you know, to try to get more of that. But I think the main problem that we're all facing is we have these macroeconomic factors that we're thinking through, in large part thanks to all the stuff that you're doing with this small desert program, our biggest fire. So excited to hear about Evergreen, you know, coming online today. But all these residents, all these office workers, how do we make them feel connected with the great city that we are working in and, you know, trying to help every day? Beyond just being physically here, it's really about being here. What do we do while we're here to make this possible? So whether it's the arts activation program that you have, or, you know, the new urban fund, there are so many things I see the EDA going in this direction, which is huge for Newark, but huge for New Brunswick and Trenton and Camden and these other centers that have the same issue. So that's what I'm most excited about, that you're working on, is not only this incredible, for projects as big as the Wind Force, Fort Monmouth, but understanding that you take these investments and at the same time of other programs or community-oriented things, then you keep top of mind always connecting those investments to the people, with the people who live in these cities, all across the city. There's a beautiful cathedral basilica. I mean, there's so much stuff like, the Cherry Blossom Festival, like, I can't possibly give justice to it. I'm happy to give the tour to anyone who wants at any time. I just encourage everybody to reach out if you're interested. George is a great internal resource for this. There's so much here, and there's so much to be able to enjoy in the city that you have all helped build, and to build up. You know, the city's gone through hard times for 50, 60 years, but it's just been incredible to watch, you know, past you and just seeing this real, like, long heralded run on, you know, finally coming. I don't know if I had any questions or I just reply, but
that's really up to the questioners. Thank you. I appreciate that. Anyone on the board?
Anyone on the phone?
You know, alum of Emeritus New York Alliance?
What are, like, three of your flagship efforts?
There are three. We're working on, like I said, a commercial corridor strategy on all these streets, but right now, according to our math, as opposed to last year, Jersey, but it's also on one end, it's Audible's headquarters, in the middle is Prudential, on the other end is City Hall, it's Rutgers, all these great angles. We're working on building up that street, very similar to what's going on at Tuckerville Square, what Audible is pretending, but just to watch it grow, but to not cause displacement, particularly for commercial displacement. Item two is we're working with Best Newark and the state on a universal broadband strategy for Newark. So whether it is our own Newark fiber or bringing in private partners, which we've just wrapped up an R&D process on, to make sure every building in Newark, commercial and residential, is wired for high-speed broadband. A big assist for the federal government for that. The last is homelessness. Homelessness, particularly around Penn Station. This is work I've worked on. Again, thank you, Police Lieutenant Governor. I was at the governor's office, I'm now the New Jersey Transit Board. New Jersey Transit is a big part of this work too. We're trying to do as much as we possibly can to end homelessness in the city with a focus on Penn and Broad Street stations. And it's all amazing work. I like that we've been able to really localize it, the specific projects. There's so much we could do, and so having those three, having things we can really pay attention to, is great.
Maybe it's a related question. Obviously, since we're proposing the way, but are there other cities that you're trying to model some of these projects after, where some cities are successful about wanting to go one of those three or something else? Or, you know, I think we've done a good job in this administration about not having private ownership all the time, like, you know, feeling good ideas from the place. I'm just wondering if anything pops to your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I brought them up earlier, but one I often refer to is Pittsburgh, where they faced a very intense deindustrialization. They lost, you know, a third or so of their population, but worked with their anchor institutions, which is what New York is meant to do with the state, with the city, like a true P3, try to have a very conscious plan about what to do about that. And so I think we've seen the successes of that in the city, where it's the center of innovation and those summits for the G20 or, you know, other big organizations internationally, where by having a conscious strategy, which again, I think Murphy administration on a big level, the Newark Alliance on a small level, you can't just kind of grope around and hope. And having that structured way of incorporating different private sector actors, different public actors, you know, the specifics, you know, we don't have yet, hopefully with that, a giant robotic center like, you know, Pittsburgh does. We are looking for the things we can hold on to. But I just think that was a really good example of this gravity cooperation that, you know, I want to help. And again, they're a similar-sized city.
Kevin, you have, I think J.P. Morgan just published a piece on Detroit and their efforts in Detroit. Have you talked to them at all? Or
Detroit is also top of the list. One of the big facts about Newark, though, is that there's another city right there that we are in the shadow of. And so one of the problems with trying to understand what we can learn from other places is we are not our own metro area. So people in Detroit all kind of left to, you know, outside Wayne County, Macomb County, Oakland County, but they're very much there. It's a story about, in a way, like bringing people back into Detroit, or investment is a better way of saying it. So I think that's been for us why I just want to always say, like, this is a great American city in itself. It's not just a New York exurb. And so Detroit also, people haven't put in money that we could not imagine here for the private sector, whether it's Dan Gilbert, loans, Chase Foundation, et cetera. I think the state has stepped up to fill a great deal of that void, in my personal opinion, but that's sort of a long-term project I think we have. Like, can we get people on the private sector to invest at the scale that they have in Detroit, major leading example?
I'll just quickly add, we did a trip to Detroit, maybe about...
Yeah, 2019.
And we met with some of the leadership that was really behind the revitalization of Detroit and asked them, you know, in hindsight, what would they have done differently? And we've heard this from kind of boots on the ground community partners. And I think they have come to a place where they've realized that the strategy wasn't equitable. And I think we have, and that's not like, you know, in an extreme way, but it was like we could have done things a bit differently. So I think we have the privilege of knowing that and kind of really curating this in a way.
What do you mean by that strategy?
I mean,
choose my words.
Well, how would you
describe that? It was very top-down. And there was one really rich person and one major foundation who really kind of set the tone, I guess you could say, and then sort of brought the community on a little bit. So, that sound right?
Yeah. Pretty self-explanatory. I sure will. Thank you.
I would like to segue on an equity, but more about your program. What I keep hearing about living in Montclair and dealing with residents is they can't afford to live here anymore because of housing and the cost of housing. And they feel they're getting pushed out by all of the development. Just wanted to know if you can respond, what are you doing about affordable housing?
Affordable housing, and there's two entities here that are worth knowing, the Equitable Growth Commission, which was started by Mayor Baraka, which Aisha also serves on, and then also Door Community Development Network, which is a long-standing affordable housing group. If I had to pinpoint, like, what is going on with the housing issue in Newark, I think it has very little to do with sort of the downtown developments or things like that. It's been activity in the investor sector buying up property, particularly in the South and West Ward. Where it's this really awful math where when you can take out debt for nothing, you can buy Newark property as a big, whether there's some big funds that are doing this, but more in Newark, it's kind of smaller family funds, I guess you could say, that are buying the property. And then they don't care about the capital, they just want the income. And they'll get as much rent as they can, not invest in it. That is the policy problem we're dealing with. I think it's far beyond, you know, anything we're seeing downtown. Between what the mayor has done and then the EPA did with respect to the requirements on any new development for affordability and for having people live in Newark, work in projects, et cetera, it's much more this activity that, frankly, I think the federal government has to deal with and that the macroeconomy has eased because debt is so expensive. Now you're not seeing people, you know, take on the same behavior, but that is the problem here that we're trying to face, which Trenton faces in a big way, you know, other cities do as well. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Very
interesting. Now, is Charles Darwin on the line?
Morning, Charles.
Well,
Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Charles. As you mentioned, I've got three kind of additional documents to walk through. I just sent around the email to the board members last night, going through ascending order of complexity. This one here, this is what Terry, Chairman mentioned, taking the call on our diner menu. It's just really not sort of self-evident, and it's really just a list of the next graphical element, or MS, which, you know, graphical element. Pop this in your briefcase, put it in your top drawer, when you're at a cocktail party, someone says, what's the small business lead grant, or I had a question for you about the New Jersey Innovation Fellows Program, at least you've got, you know, enough to be dangerous to say, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
That's nice.
But just click that. So this is an ever-expanding list, obviously. We'll probably be on page 4 by the time you you know, print this again in a couple of weeks.
I mean, I think we should laminate this and put a picture of pancakes up.
Yeah, exactly. And also, if you put the pricing in stickers, you can change them. and so, again, this is literally just meant as a handy reference guide. It is not, by the way, exhaustive. There are programs that aren't on here. There are opportunities that aren't on here, but this is kind of the frequent flyers. A lot of these are the things we started under Governor Murphy, so more likely to be sort of on people's minds or on their list of other folks. Some of these are programs that are kind of under design. So I had to mention the Urban Investment Fund. That's noted here. It's upcoming. No one can apply. So I'm too excited to see you open a program for it. But this has a bit of coming attraction as well. So hopefully helpful again, literally just for your briefcase, your test drawer, whatever. Second, more substantially, this document, the purpose of the board dashboard. And George Santos gave us grief for having used the word board twice. But this is meant to be, again, this is not exhaustive. This is not our annual report. This is not everything that ever has ever happened, even in the first 9 months of the year, but meant to be, again, just sort of a quick desktop review of major things that are happening, you know, month by month, year to date, lifetime first. So some of these programs are on the front page, like NOL, go back to the 90s, and, you know, with $2 billion or so of approvals, not all over this year. But it does, I think, accurately reflect the depth and breadth and the magnitude of what we're doing in any given moment or any given year. So in, you know, year to date, nearly $1 billion of approvals across various programs. As I mentioned, I'm really, really proud of the fact that they span the run the gamut from big chunky approvals for things like Aspire to security planning grants that aren't actually on this list, but they could be. But Fridge is not an approval yet, but you know, child care and manufacturing and some of the mainstream programs, all of which are much more micro interventions that roll up into a quite substantial, not just money, but impact. On the back, you also have a summary of two things. One, tax credit certification. So again, a program project like a GROW still doesn't do this until probably the end of time. Aspire, Emerge, historic tax credit program, Brownfield, those have a very long license. So you would approve something on day one, 3 or 4 years later, that project's when it's done with construction, it's done with implementation, is dealing with Bruce and his team on certifications, making sure they did what they said they were going to do. That is a tremendous amount of volume and activity as well, and that happens in many emanations past a board meeting. But this reflects what's going on there as well. So another $500 million of approval certifications, largely under the vast majority of those are legacy GROW programs. We haven't yet issued a single tax credit for her to expire yet, just given the timing of those. Emerge probably coming sometime soon, probably by the end of this year. We'll have one or two of the first certifications of those, pretty not a huge volume program. But anyway, so again, reflects the huge amount of work. And again, when we were dealing with a lot of questions about how we did tax credit certifications, this was a very, very hot topic. Didn't want to lose sight of this there's a tremendous amount of work that goes on behind the scenes on this, and deeply appreciative of the way we're sitting on the shop. And then our financial position. So revenues, expenses, you know, we're making more, you know, taking in more than we're spending, et cetera. You can see through this year, a pretty positive position we find ourselves in that is overwhelmingly due to a reserve and interest rates and the amount of interest we earn on our cash. Not a problem. That's a good thing. As well as we need to see some rebounds in, you know, things like our financing fees as some of the programs get active and rocking and rolling, and we manage our costs within the plan, which is our job. And by the way, this notes that these are through August. These are 8 month numbers. We'll finish the 9 month numbers probably later tomorrow, but they weren't ready for the board, so these will usually sort of lag behind just a month. And we will we'll be back in December for our financial plan for next year. I wanted everyone to sort of preview. So again, this you can expect monthly, plus or minus, unless we have some technical issue. But again, big appreciation to Bruce and his team for pulling all the data together, and Emma and Maggie, who are work somewhere on pulling this together. Why don't I pause there? These are kind of reports on activity before I jump into other things. Any comments, observations?
The only new, you know, the staggering thing to me is the new person here is when you look at the far right column, you know, both tax credit certifications and approval, it's $7.5 billion. You know, it's quite substantial.
Yeah. It's staggering. Yeah. So look for this, again, on a regular basis. Again, hopefully helpful. Just as a,
how many manufacturing directory with us? 200, I don't know.
That way you have at least a bit of a backdrop there. There are two other documents that are formatted a little differently. They're formatted differently. As I mentioned earlier, the Stronger and Fairer Economic Development Plan that the governor issued turned 5 on October 1st, 2023. We thought it was an appropriate time to do a bit of a step back of saying all the things we said we were going to do in that report. How are we doing? Did we actually do them? Are they on track? Do them or not do them? So why? And then also, what is the impact? You know, we committed in that plan to 5 macro, pretty, you know, big, audacious goals. I'll go through them in some detail, but how are we doing? You know, how are we? It is impossible to draw a causal arrow between, like, well, we had a, you know, manufacturing grant program, so therefore, the, you know, we created next jobs. That's not how this works. But, you know, the look at the input and the outputs here to do a quick review. I won't go through this line by line, and it's good reading, but there were 39 specific identified goals or sort of task items, action items identified in the plan, and those occupy the first 4 pages of this deck. 33 of them are, you know, rated here as accomplished. There's probably some friendly grading, there's some home team grading here, but some of those could probably be characterized as, you know, in process still. But 33 done, check. 4 marked as in progress, and 2 that are fine schedule. And I can assure you when a certain person has an office down the hall saw this list, those 2 are being reactivated. As we speak, we had a long meeting yesterday about reactivating one of them. And so again, of those 39 things, again, you know, check in the box, at least of starting a program, launching a program, having a program, doing something, 33 to 39, pretty darn good. But this is not just an EDA scorecard. A lot of this is the EDA. I'm not very proud of that, but this is a real, you know, whole of government and partnership with legislators. First on the list happens to be raising minimum wage. Rob is responsible for implementing that. The legislature needed to pass it. The governor needed to sign it. So a lot of this is whole of government, not just EDA stuff, although we have a lot of the list as well.
You're selling us short. The minimum wage for this report when we started the plan was 8.60, not 14.13, so that's increased minimum wage.
I think it was a year over year. But yeah, you're in the
8.13.
You like round numbers?
13 cents.
Before we tribute to 13, is that like a tribute to something?
Friday the 13th is
This reflects what we thought we were going to do in the late summer, early fall of 2018. A couple things happened along the way.
Not the way that we did with the pandemic.
So it's not as if there's been a list of 19 other things, programs. So again, it's just this is an EBA scorecard, lots of things other people did as well, ECIA, HSA, and NGRA in particular. This doesn't include dealing with contillions of unemployment claims and all things about this deep in. But another 19 programs and initiatives that we've undertaken as well. So again, from a overall volume of effort, and from did we do what we say we were going to do, said we were going to do, I feel really good. Again, appreciate the support of this board, folks on the board previously, our team, some of them is here, sister agencies, you know, cousin agencies, whatever the relationship is, that enable this work, and of course the governor for giving us the resources to do it, and the legislature for having our back too as well. So I feel really good about this. You know, a lot of these, again, are things we said start the program, now we have the program, do the program, make it happen, and make sure it has the impact and the connectivity that
Kevin
was describing to the people who live here in the state. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, of course.
Let me just interrupt.
Sure.
My only criticism is, got to get this one. I feel as though most people, most businesses that are directly affected by all the good things we're doing are unaware. I mean, we need a cheat sheet. They need something as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I know it's always money in order to do that, but I really think we should be shouting from the rooftops.
Because
this is very fabulous.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. I want to pause. Any other comments, questions, concerns? Again, there's more to do. There is no mission accomplished. I'm flattered by the comparison, but there's no mission accomplished. Anyway, we have a ton of work to do. As soon as this meeting breaks, we get back to hitting it hard on doing those things, but I'm really, really proud of the input scorecard here. Any comments, questions? On the output side, not surprisingly, some really big successes and some things that are work left undone. And first of all, no one thought we were going to achieve strength and fairness in a 5-year period. But we had set, just a trip down memory lane on the first page, 5 really specific goals, and I think they were bold then. You look back and you're like, well, that was really bold. And they were all kind of a matrix of, one, we wanted to care about the right metrics. So there's things in here like poverty. That is, I think, we were the first in the nation, I'll publish a copy of this, I'm tracking that closely, to sort of establish poverty as an economic development goal, not just a sort of justice and equity and good right thing. We also really focused on wages, excuse me, jobs and quality of jobs and wages. There's no reference to GDP in this. There's no reference to the unemployment rate, which is sort of the, you know, a statistical derivation that is tricky to match, but how many jobs. And also, you got to sort of be cognizant and mindful that, to a certain extent, the macro market globally, nationally, regionally, gives you an opportunity set, and you want to sort of beat your competitors, in our case, the other states. You know, we're in on, for a state that is as large economically, that is well-developed, that is as dense as we are, we're not going to grow jobs faster than any state in America. That's not, we did our rapid growing in the 20th century and the 19th century. But can we meet the competitors in the Northeast? You know, we wanted to set that as a benchmark. And there's only so much you can do versus your peer set. And so we also looked at things like VC investment overall, but also jobs for minorities and men in the staff. Yeah, those are big, complicated questions. That's not a magic wand. That's not pass a law that says there should be more women and minorities in staff, and it happened. That's not how it works. The scorecard here is in some cases really strong, and in some cases revealed the work left to be done. I won't go through these in great detail, but the jobs goal, you know, we said 300,000 jobs by 2025 to lead the region in job growth. We're on track for the 300,000. We'll get there or not, we'll see. But we're on track at this milestone, and we have been number one in the region for job creation, private sector job creation, the last 3 years. Pretty good. I feel really good about that. And but I remember Rob and I were chuckling when, you know, during the depths of the pandemic, when Rob was putting out stats saying we were hemorrhaging jobs by the tens of thousands a week. I was like, oh, crap, we're going to have to reset the scorecards. We're not going to get that. But, you know, thanks to the CARES Act and, you know, massive response from the federal government and the state government, we're back on track and again ahead of peers on basically track for our goal on the overall jobs. On the wages side, again, the inflation plays a complicated factor in speaking about wages, but again, we've tracked various periods ahead of or tracked the peers in the Northeast. We are ahead of the goal. Again, inflation renders the 4% goal a bit wonky to look at. These are real numbers, but real, not notional, but again, we've done pretty well here, so pretty good grades, again, compared to the opportunity set. Included whenever we talk about peers in the Northeast, Pennsylvania, my insistence is always included. Some people consider Pennsylvania part of the Midwest because they play Big Ten football, and parts of Pennsylvania are quite Midwestern. But I think of it as the Northeast, particularly when people point to them and say, why can't we be more like Pennsylvania? We're doing better than them on virtually every sport you can imagine. Not that I'm competitive. It's great. A lot of people live there, but we're better. The third goal, women and minorities in STEM, again, doing well on women, less well on minorities. And this reminds us of the work that we continue to do, and some of the programs we've launched trying to be helpful there are just barely getting off the ground. So the Black Latino Seed Fund, the SETI Seed Fund, some of the things that we're doing to try and make very specific interventions there, hopefully change that trajectory. But again, on plan on women, a bit of a high plan on minorities in STEM. Venture capital, really strong, so well ahead of plan on the absolute dollars. We've also bumped up our rankings quite a bit. Team now in the high single digits. So that's good. The venture market has gone quite quiet, although we're about to make our first venture investment in the Evergreen Fund in a few minutes. So continuing to hit that goal. The racial and racial and gender wage gap, again, not terribly surprising we didn't fix that in 3 or 4 or 5 years, but just doing better than peers on women. Doing on plan or so for Hispanic employment and wage gaps, the Black wage gap is not narrowed. So that is a reminder of work left undone. Again, that's a regional story, that's a national story. But when we get back to our desk, hit it hard, think about what we're doing and why we do it. That one plus goal 5. We said we wanted to, we're not going to eradicate poverty in 5 years, first of all. But we said we want to bring our city's average in line with the statewide average. Think about it from an inequality perspective. And that's quite articulate, and that we have a tremendous amount of work to do still there. Again, COVID and the disproportionate effect on our cities exacerbated this a bit, but not entirely. This is a reminder of places we got to continue to hit it hard. When we think about economic security and small business and community development and developing our, you know, continuing to focus on connecting job creation in our cities to folks who live here. The work remains. A lot of work remains. And so, again, I take some comfort from some of the stats, and I take some renewed commitment to hitting it hard and doubling down on some of our things we know I can do. Again, some of these things are global. Some of these things are national. Some of these things are regional. Some of these are things we can control. We can control. Shame on us if we're not hitting it hard, you know, every day and thinking about it. So, anyways, we said we should hold ourselves accountable and give ourselves a scorecard. I feel pretty good about the scorecard. Not perfect. Yeah, some of these goals were audacious enough that we're supposed to have continued accountability and continued persistence around achieving them. Poverty, and because poverty is an economic indicator, I give the governor a tremendous amount of credit for standing up tall and saying we're going to care about poverty as an economic matter, not just as a justice and equity matter. It's those things too. It's a big goal, and we have work to do. So I appreciate the board's continued support in attacking those challenges. At the end of my rather extended CEO report, we've got a lot to talk about, a lot to share, and happy to take any questions or comments or reactions. I'll give the floor back to the good chairman.
But I think, thank you, Tim. There's a lot to digest, especially in the McKinsey reports we got last night. So, you know, I think it's a good topic maybe for our strategic retreat to dive deeper into some of these, or, you know, as people have a chance to digest. But hopefully the board gets a sense that we're trying to be, you know, to provide you with data and statistics that we can use to benchmark our progress and how we're doing on various questions. All right, so with that, we're going to dive into the agenda, which I think we can hopefully move through relatively quickly to get everybody on schedule. So the first thing I'm going to do is give a audit committee report as the chair of the audit committee. We had a follow-up meeting on October 5th as a follow-up to our August 30th audit committee meeting. We ran out of time at the August 30th meeting, and so we wanted to have a special follow-up meeting to get briefed on the portfolio review and risk report. Since that wasn't covered in the audit committee, and we achieved that at our meeting on October 5th. Next, we're going to turn to the policy committee. I'm going to give a report. Then I'm going to turn this section, the next item, over to Ginny. The policy committee met on September 28th. The committee began with an overview of the Atlantic City Food Security Grants Pilot Program memo, which we will discuss in a few moments. This was followed by a presentation on three various clean energy related MOUs, one pertaining to working with the NJ Commission on Science, Innovation, and Technology to implement clean energy and clean tech programs, one pertaining to working with the NJ DEP to use NJEDA RENT funds to support the NJDEP's peaceful modernization program, and one with the NJBPU to support workforce development in the offshore wind industry, all of which I think we're discussing today.
Yeah, you get a big go for using all those acronyms correctly.
I got Reggie. staff presented a recommendation for additional funding for temporary staff to support the administration of the Main Street Recovery grant, which we will discuss today. They also presented on continuing disclosure policies and procedures. A number of FYI items were discussed, including the draft charter for the policy committee, quarterly update on the New Jersey wind port, which the committee receives, and board experience, as I mentioned during my chair remarks earlier. A staff presented a recommendation for the first investment in our Innovation Evergreen Fund. Aisha and I will be recusing ourselves from this discussion. My family foundation has an investment in New Jersey Venture Partners, Newark Venture Partners, which is an investor in the Target company, as does Audible, I believe. So we will both be recusing. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Ginny to lead us through the vote.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are asking to approve a qualified investment under New Jersey Innovation. As he mentioned, Innovation Evergreen Fund, a qualified investment approval under Venture, and I think Alexander Ackman will be presenting, please.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you today to present our first recommendation for a qualified investment under the New Jersey Innovation Evergreen Fund program. It's an exciting moment for the program and for the state's innovation economy. As a reminder, the Evergreen Fund is a partnership with the private sector that raises and co-invests funds in high-growth, innovative New Jersey companies to increase venture capital funding available to the state's ecosystem. To fund initial program investments and expenses, the EDA completed the successful sale of $50 million of program tax credits, which was approved by the board in December 2022. The corporation is committed to supporting the state's innovation economy. The fund has $46.1 million of available capital ready to be deployed today. To date, the board has approved 10 qualified venture firms, also known as QVFs under the program, which are eligible to apply for investment funding. This month, the Venture Programs Department is presenting the program's first recommendation for a qualified investment. Applications for qualified investments are reviewed in the order in which they are received and reviewed on a rolling basis. Following staff review, the recommendation offered here today has met all program eligibility requirements as determined by the EDA's Venture Programs Department in conjunction with the EDA's Product Operations Department, which independently reviews all program applications to ensure objectivity of review. The description of eligibility requirements and confidential transaction details are included in the recommendation memos in your packets. As a reminder, the program largely relies on the investment expertise of the qualified venture firms that evaluate the quality of investment opportunities through their normal course of business. EDA staff's role is to establish eligibility and alignment with program rules as determined by the program regulations and legislation. Without further ado, the qualified investment applicant recommended for certification today is an application by the qualified venture firm Emerging Fund Management, LLC, for a $500,000 investment into the Series A3 preferred stock financing round of One Huddle, Inc., an innovative high-growth New Jersey business based right here in Newark. Emerging Fund, as you may recall, was approved as a program qualified venture firm last month. Upon approval, staff will reserve up to an additional $100,000 for related management fee expenses and up to an additional $140,000 for direct administrative expenses, such as special purpose legal startup and wind down costs, and to cover the costs of an annual audit of the SPV. Under the program, the authority shall have the right but not the obligation to make subsequent follow-on investments from the Evergreen Fund into qualified businesses. The authority will reserve fund capital for follow-on investments within approved program limits. To align in lockstep proportion with the amount reserved for subsequent follow-on investment into One Huddle by the Emerging Fund, upon approval, the program will reserve an additional $3.5 million for follow-on investments into One Huddle, Inc. On program eligibility, following staff review, Emerging Fund Management LLC remained eligible to receive a program qualified investment. The Emerging Fund is a Chicago-based growth equity fund investing at the intersection between technology and the service sector with $44.2 million in assets under management. Following staff review, the innovative high-growth New Jersey business, One Huddle, Inc., is also eligible to receive a program qualified investment as a high-growth qualified business whose principal business operations are located in the state. So for a brief overview of One Huddle, the company is a Newark-based enterprise software and service platform operating in the information and high technology industry that enables companies to convert static workforce training materials into dynamic, quick-burst mobile games to educate, elevate, and energize company employees. One Huddle anticipates using capital raised for future expenses, in part to expand its New Jersey-based sales and marketing and customer service teams. Following approval, the Emerging Fund will establish a special purpose vehicle, which will be funded by program capital to execute the qualified investment into One Huddle, Inc. The program qualified investment will match an investment made by the Emerging Fund using the firm's own capital to occur on the same transaction terms. The EDA is effectively a co-investor. In conclusion, staff plans to continue to present additional qualified investments for approval on a regular basis as we seek to leverage the pipeline of engaged venture capital partners developed through the program to invest in high-growth New Jersey companies. I'll end my prepared remarks by reiterating staff's recommendation for approval of the application for qualified investment. Thank you for your consideration, and we welcome any questions at this time.
Thank you, Alexander. May I have a motion to move this forward, please?
So move, Lalacha.
Second, please.
Second, Marcia.
Thank you, Marcia. Any discussion? Questions?
Just real quick comment, there's not specifically One Huddle, which I spoke about, by the way. More investment companies, one of the biggest purchasers in the state is the state of New Jersey. Is there anything we can do to incentivize them to get on the state procurement schedule? If they're obviously services that are funded by the state.
Good question. There's complicated church and state stuff there. Church and state stuff there. We've got to be thoughtful about how we approach it. But I think there's a process for which folks to get on those lists. And, connect them. Anything beyond that, it's a little more complicated, but yeah, great suggestion. Thank you.
Anything else? Any other questions? Okay. With that, may I have approval? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any dissensions? Anyone besides Chairman and Aisha who have to recuse? Okay. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you. We have Sam here. Sam is the CEO of One Huddle. Is that right?
Yes.
Just want to say a couple of quick words.
Real quick, yes. I got to get back to work.
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah.
I just want to say thank you to the NJDA, the governor, and everybody involved. You know, this investment is a big deal for us. Invest in people, invest in our product, invest in the people on the other side of our product, on the workforce side that are using it every day. So with that, thank you, and I'm excited for all to come.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're out of the
can we call the lottery?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, next we're going to go to real estate. Charles, you're on the line. Can you give us a quick a few words on the real estate committee's work?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So the real estate committee met on September 28th. The staff presented three memos for the committee to review. First was a pilot program related to local property acquisition grant program, which is grant funding for the acquisition of properties by the public entities and not-for-profits, and very exciting program that we think is going to be widely accepted in the community. Second one was delegation for Fort Monmouth Economic Revitalization Authority related to the New Jersey Bioscience Center step-out labs. And then the last memo that was presented was a contract amendment for an MOU between the NJEDA and Fort Monmouth for reimbursement of additional consultant costs. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Charles.
If I could, Chairman, Vice Chairman, a good reminder of why we have committees and how they work. I think Charles had mentioned this at last month's meeting. This first program we're going to have come through actually was presented for this September cycle at the committee meeting, and there were a lot of questions, really good suggestions of, this is close, but here's a couple tweaks we think would make it better, you know, those questions we had. So back in the shop we went, made some adjustments and tweaks. Here we are with the proposal. This is ready for front end.
Okay.
Fully ready for front
end. Okay, good. So the first item is the local property acquisition program, and Dan Jennings is going to present.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman, members of the board. We are requesting your approval to establish the Local Property Acquisition Grant Program. We are also requesting authorization to fund this program with $25 million from the state's FY23 Appropriations Act. As noted, this is a pilot program in which we will invite and score applications on a competitive basis. So why this program? So we are establishing this program to facilitate the future redevelopment of properties that meet local or regional economic objectives. The program addresses several challenges. The first is the situation in which a property owner is unwilling or unable to redevelop a property in an area that a municipality wants to see redeveloped. The second is a situation in which a property could be assembled with adjoining properties to create a project that a municipality deems important. The third is a situation where the municipality is targeting a use for a property that it believes will better fulfill redevelopment objectives. Given these challenges, we are inviting and limiting the application or the applicant pool to municipalities, municipal instrumentalities, county instrumentalities, and not-for-profit local economic and community development entities to apply. We held this listening session in July, well attended, which confirmed strong interest in the program. Based on feedback received to date, we are proposing two funding projects. The first is a $3 million acquisition pot that will result in the creation of publicly accessible improvements. These improvements must support ongoing, existing, and our future redevelopment. These improvements can include a pedestrian plaza, a public park, a public walkway, a public parking lot or garage, a community park, or a community garden. Under this project, the minimum grant would be $50,000 and the maximum grant would be $1 million. The second and larger bucket is a $21 million pot for acquisitions that result in future development projects. Such a project could be a mixed-use development, a transit-oriented development, a cultural arts or performance venue, commercial space, manufacturing industrial space, or research or laboratory space. Under this product category, the minimum grant would be $50,000 and the maximum would be $4 million. This program would cover a max of 80% of the appraised value plus closing costs, except in the cases of transitional aid communities and government-restricted municipalities, where we're proposing to cover up to 100% of appraised value. In the memo, we propose application and scoring criteria similar to other real estate and EDA programs, prevailing wage, affirmative action, and other labor requirements will apply to future projects and publicly accessible improvements. For most municipalities, there would be an award cap of one project per product category, with the exception of transitional aid communities and government-restricted municipalities, where we would allow a maximum of two awards per product category. In the grant agreement, we will have deed restrictions, consent rights, and recapture provisions to hold awardees accountable, guide future property transfers as applicable, and ensure that a future project is not excessively enriched. We will seek future board approval for all recommended awards following an internal scoring committee review. EDA will retain up to 4% or $1 million as the admin fee. Then the application fee would be $1,000, except we can grant waivers to municipal applicants and municipalities whose MRR score rank in the top 10%. The board member before you is requesting approval of the Local Property Acquisition Grant Program, utilizing $25 million and delegating authority to adjust funding amounts between the two funding products based on the demand for each. At this point, happy to take your
question. Also, grammatic question. If it's a vacant site or a building or a facility or a question, or do all those things have to be vacant to be eligible?
Well, they have to be vacant or underutilized.
Okay.
Right. Like, if it's a fully utilized, fully functioning property wouldn't
work. Would that be flat, though? Could have a strike. Could be flat.
Quick question, Dan.
Sure.
I think this program is amazing. I guess in order to access the acquisition funds, will the applicant have to otherwise have their financing and ensure that they're getting to closing? So how do we prevent, you know, them ultimately just getting on their site?
Yeah, great question. So in the application, we will ask the applicant to identify the matching source. The 20% where that's coming from and show some evidence of that. And then in the grant agreement post-board approval, we will have a deed restriction. So they'll have to abide by timeline. We're definitely trying to avoid land banking.
If they don't post, we will close. If they don't find the rest of the money, we will close.
And the deed restriction would allow you to take the property back?
Yes.
And the source for this fund is general appropriation. To the EDA. Got it. 2023.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions for Dan? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve? Second?
Second, Joel.
Any discussion, further discussion? Hearing none, could I hear a vote? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, none heard. Motion passes. Congratulations, Dan. Good luck.
Thank you.
Dagger menu's now already at the
We're on the back page.
It's a live document.
Okay, the next items, I think we have two that Juana's going to present. The first is the former Meyer Center in Fort Monmouth.
Good morning. Staff is requesting that the members approve an amendment to the TM Associates contract to come further and hopefully at this point complete the environmental groundwater monitoring to obtain a classification area exemption, a CEA, for groundwater that we discovered when during the demolition we found and remediate. So we're requesting to amend the contract by $117,000. And we're also requesting that you delegate to the CEO the ability to increase the contract by an additional $150,000 if it's found that we need additional work after the series of testing is done. So the short of it, we have a very long history. The authority entered into a contract with TNM Services, which is approved by the board. Demolition remediation stuff. It allows the Meyer Center 700,000 square foot building on parcel F1 by controlled property. In 2017, we entered into a sale and redevelopment agreement with Premier to purchase the parcel. That agreement also permitted the modification of the acquisition. The agreement was we're going to hopefully not damage anything to the parcel now over time to redevelop. And then lo and behold, in 2018, we can unsolicit a call from RWJ Barnabas to essentially purchase an assignment of our agreement just for the whole 36 acres. Which the board approved in 2018. Between 2017 and 2020, we proceeded to do the environmental remediation and demolition of the 700,000 square feet. And during the demolition, we found a UST, which we remediated, and groundwater contamination was discovered, and we commenced end testing. In 2021, the members approved additional testing and installation of groundwater monitoring well. And at that time, the board authorized the authority to obtain a classification area exemption for the contaminated area. So we continue to do testing. In 2022, RWJ purchases our agreement, buys the property from Vermeera, but we're continuing to do the testing according to 2021 approval. And in the middle of this year, in 2023, we discovered that we needed to do further monitoring to obtain the classification exception. So the request to increase the contract is for that purpose. In addition, just in case there's an additional testing that comes up, we're asking you to authorize the CEO for an additional $150,000 testing so we don't have to come to the board and do this all over again. Additionally, the members should be aware, separately, under delegated authority, we would be entering into a MOU with Premiera for reimbursement of these costs. Any questions?
Does this jeopardize at all RWJ's?
No, project. The intention is asking for that change to develop the site. Something that's not in our control there is there to align it there that the Army is responsible for cleaning up, and I don't know the timeline for completing that. So
I was just going to ask, would this complete the testing? I mean, this sounds like it continued to be an ongoing problem.
It depends on what the next round of testing found, whether there are any more contaminants found, and if they're at acceptable levels, I believe the CEA would be issued with the requirement to do further testing. The intent is, I believe, is to remediate by natural attenuation and not accident.
But the federal government is going to be cleaning that?
Not for this site. There's a separate area on the site called the Lime Pit, which is a bunch of chemicals. I think it's in the Flynn development. That little area is still, I believe, under control by the Army, and they have responsibility in that area.
The Army Corps.
Yeah.
authority. Right? It's a $100,000 expenditure.
Next matter up, we have some discussion of that exact topic, yes.
Any further discussion, questions on this? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank
second,
you.
Roger.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Not heard. The motion passes. Okay, Wanda, this is another Fort Monmouth topic, correct?
Yes, one of them is in two of them are not.
Okay.
So, under the approved 2022 board policy, real estate staff is requesting the following additional delegation from the board to the chief executive officer. The first one has to do with the authority to name the new developer in the Premier statute itself. So the authority has the power to redevelop property at the fort if they enter into a redevelopment agreement with Premier. It has never done so to date. In addition, the fort can enter into redevelopment agreements with private parties. And historically, under the Vice Attorney General's office, the authority's members have consented to those private agreements to recognize that the authority is foregoing its right to redevelop that lot. To date, the authority has not exercised its power to redevelop any property on the Premier campus. We have entered into the agreement to purchase property, but we have never entered and finalized the redevelopment. To date, the members have consented to 24 private redevelopment agreements, and only one exceeds the level of authority which we're seeking delegation for. And what we're seeking delegation for is for any agreement up to $12,500,000, which is consistent with Office of State Comptroller's power of pre-review and pre-approval of contracts. And so staff means that's an appropriate level that each member should review the agreement. The other two delegations have to do with two programs that operate at New Jersey Bio Science Center, and they're very similar in nature. Essentially, in both programs, as a step out lab and incubators, agreements can only be terminated for financial hardship. The request is to permit determination agreements without financial hardship if the following conditions are met in either the incubator or the step out lab. That the replacing tenant has to be standing, and if it's an incubator tenant, that it has to be approved by the advisory board. That the replacing tenant agrees to accept the space that's being relinquished by the current tenant, that the total square footage being occupied by the replacement tenant does exceed either program guidelines, either one is 6,000 and one 8,000 in the other program, and that there is no gap in the text. So under either of those, under those conditions, you would authorize staff to approve a termination of agreement with a replacement and subsequent new agreement with a replacement tenant. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Anyone on the phone? Okay, hearing none, can I hear a motion to approve the, I guess we're approving all three together? One motion.
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. And second?
Motion about second.
Thank you. Hearing any further discussion, hearing none, can I hear a vote? All those signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed or abstentions? Hearing none being heard, the motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone who's having trouble keeping track of the Bioscience Center versus the Step Out Labs versus the BDC versus all that, we are overwhelmingly likely doing our board retreat at the Bioscience Center, and the tour will be part of that. It'll give you a puncher's chance to understand the difference between those things.
Okay. All right, next we're going to go to economic security. Tara Colton is going to present on the Atlantic City Food Security Program Grants Pilot Program.
While Tara takes the roster, let's do a little bit of framing here. So. One, we've been at it under Tara's leadership on food security for some time. Atlantic City happens to rank number two, which is not, you don't want to rank two, you have to rank, you might be off the list of food desert communities in the state. Number one, by the way, Camden. There's been a longstanding and to date fruitless effort to develop a full-scale grocery store in Atlantic City, led by our partners at CRDA. That front, their most recent attempts ended in September, and there was a pretty strong directive to us from the governor's office, the governor himself, that we needed an action plan to jump in to help people who need access to fresh, healthy, affordable food now, not several years now, when a next effort to develop a grocery store might bear fruit, if that's possible, given the dynamics of the, what's that?
Bear fruit and vegetables.
Bear fruit and vegetables, fresh, healthy, dairy, beef, et cetera. And so Tara, and with great support from Christine Fuentes, the folks who spent a lot of time in Atlantic City, jumped into it and said, what's an action plan we can put together? Fortunately, we have both a food security effort and a robust Atlantic City effort, and we have some resources that we're able to be redirected and put forward here. So this is what Tara's going to describe in a moment is, one, incredibly impressive for having come together in a couple weeks. Two, not going to solve the problem long-term of food security in Atlantic City, but is going to provide, we hope, some near-term immediate relief for that crisis and also set the stage for a broader systems intervention. Now, also note, probably a coming attraction for things we're going to want to do in other high-ranking, low-ranking food desert communities across the state as we get the proceeds from the food desert tax credit auction, which we just announced today is going from $10 to $15 million. We've got good demand there, so we'll have resources to take a run at the challenge of food security or food insecurity in our city, starting in Atlantic City. Tara.
Thank you. And I want to first start by acknowledging that part of the passion commitment that we all bring to this is on our Lieutenant Governor's legacy and commitment to Atlantic City.
Sorry, can you speak?
Sorry. I'm saying that part of what we're trying to bring to this is the commitment to honor the Lieutenant Governor's commitment to Atlantic City. I think we, the people of Atlantic City, need to do right by them, but we also need to deliver on her passion for improving the city and finally bringing resources to a community that has not had the investment that it needs for so long. I want to thank Tim and the board for your thoughtful comments in our policy committee meeting 2 weeks ago. As Tim referenced, this is something we pulled together in a matter of weeks. It is not an approach I recommend. It has been a bit frenzied, but we're very proud that we were able to deliver something with a very comprehensive approach. I want to start by acknowledging and thanking Rucha Godfrey, Riley Edwards, and Brian Todd on my team that are our food security gurus, Christina Fuentes, who is our expert on all things Atlantic City, and Gabriel for jumping in over and over again, along with our secret weapon, Fred Bernard, who collectively has helped us get us to you today. Part of the reason, as Tim alluded to, that we were able to develop a proposal and hit the ground running on this idea is the fact that we've been preparing for additional funding to come online for us to support innovative approaches to addressing food insecurity throughout the state. So when there were questions or ideas about how this could be addressed in Atlantic City, we already had ideas in our queue. We'd already been looking at best practices. We'd already been doing research on what's being done around the country. I've shared this before, but it's very clear that there's not just one solution to addressing food insecurity. Supermarkets, not a magic bullet. If and when it finally does come online in Atlantic City, there are 41,000 people there. They deserve a supermarket, but that doesn't solve their problems. And it needs to recognize as we develop a food security plan that that it isn't just about bringing people to food, it's about bringing food to people. And so we're excited to have developed this approach that we think will allow for a really comprehensive and holistic approach to addressing food insecurity and build on that commitment from the governor and the legislature and again, honoring the legislature and governor. And just sort of in closing before I share this particular, as Tim mentioned, we see this as a playbook for potential expansion or replication in many of the other food desert communities. Just as a preview, the other highest, aka worst ranking ones on our list, have some commonalities, but also quite a few differences. And they are Camden, Atlantic City, Newark, Trenton, City of Salem, and Passaic. And they're all sliced and diced in different ways, geographically. But that would give us a pretty rich tax rate to start working with it if we feel like this bears fruit and vegetables. It's really hard to do this and not have food conflict all the time. So there will be So what we're bringing to the members today is requesting you to approve the creation of the Atlantic City Food Security Grant Pilot Program. Maybe we'll come up with a better name for it later, but focus on the substance, not the name. It is going to be a $5.25 million program with grants made between $50,000 and $500,000, funded by two sources, $4 million in FY24 funding through the Mass Rescue Plan State and Local Fiscal Recovery Fund, federal dollars. There's a $30 million appropriation to EDA for Atlantic City, and so we're asking for your approval to utilize $4 million of that funding for this program, and then also to essentially shift $1.5 million in funding that was FY22 $8 that was originally earmarked for our fridge program, which is where we pay for the cost of refrigerated lockers for grocery delivery. We are continuing to move forward with that program. We actually are very close to making our first approval for right here in Newark, which will be very exciting. But right now, we don't have the demand for the program commensurate with the funding we appropriated, and so we want to leave some of the funding there but take some out to address these urgent needs. We would also be asking for, once the program is approved, to waive fees for applicants given the number of hardships faced by residents within the city, as well as a number of the qualifying conditions subject to ARP. Asking for delegation to the CEO to approve applications, as well as enter into two MOUs. One would be with our partner, the Department of Health. We are utilizing up to $250,000 of funding for them to expand a new initiative they're embarking on called the Healthy Corner Stores Initiative, and we'd like to boost the resources that are available for that focus on Atlantic City, since Atlantic City really gets some extra resources there. Also, approval to enter into an MOU with Community Affairs to accept the $4 million in funding, as well as give us the ability to accept, if it comes online, up to $10 million in additional funds, and to approve the reallocation of the funding from the FRIDGE program to this program. So that's the overview of what we are bringing to you today, and I'm very grateful for all the input and the teamwork to get us to this point. Have a good day.
Did I understand you correctly that there's not a food market in
not a full service supermarket? Yeah, there's a smaller market called Save-A-Lot that has Cosmic Depot, I think is a diplomatic way of putting it, but they have not had a full service supermarket since 2006.
This program is meant to supplement a larger funding, because obviously 50K to 500,000 is not enough to develop a supermarket.
Right. This is a supplement and sort of companion program to what we envision will come online when our food desert tax credits launch, which we are anticipating will open in December of this year. And so through that funding, we have over 6 years, almost $250 million available that would be made to offset both development and operating costs of supermarkets of new or rehabilitated supermarkets in food deserts. And so then you're getting into the millions, and we expect that will support most likely any feasible, long-term, sustainable supermarket in Atlantic City that will certainly need those tax credits. But even if you snap your fingers and award it up tomorrow, the supermarket doesn't exist tomorrow, and the supermarket isn't the only solution. So we're trying to kind of come at it so that when you are fast forward 5 years, hopefully Atlantic City has all of the community-driven, locally supported efforts and a supermarket. That's what things are.
We talked about this a little bit in committee, but maybe give some examples of what you think could happen in the next 6 months. You know, what actually...
Yeah, so we were able to design this program quickly because we've been contemplating what would we do if we had some flexible funding to support food security. So what we have proposed is sort of a diner menu of sorts, choose your adventure of how you want to address food security. We put some conditions on who would be eligible to apply. They have to have a track record of working in Atlantic City, have experience in food security or food access. But then the kinds of initiatives they could request funding for could vary. It could be buying a vehicle to do mobile produce or food delivery. It could be improvements to an existing small retailer to outfit it or buy freezers. It could be to expand a food pantry. It could be to increase the staffing at a farmer's market, especially around the utilization of federal nutrition benefits. So we're trying to design the program so that all of those types of projects would potentially be eligible, so that we aren't doing a farmer's market program and a truck buying program. We try to cast a wider net there.
And those are things that presumably could happen quickly.
Yes.
I'm usually advocating for community engagement within each of our programs. I guess I'm just curious why that's included here. If folks just need access to fresh food and there's a bit of what feels like a dire situation, is this too much to really be asking a food service provider to talk about how, and I know I brought this up a little bit in the committee meeting, but now that I'm like reading it again, it feels like a lot.
It's a fair question. We actually talked about that. We sort of tried to play out the different scenarios. So if you're a food pantry, talking about how you engage the community is, because you had actually, that's a very straightforward thing. If you're a small market, Christina, again, our Atlantic City expert told us about Boom Market, which is, you know, a place that I think is a popular place to shop. What would, when we went back and forth, say, how would a Boom Market respond to something like this? What would they write? We did initially actually in a draft have it as a requirement, and we took that out because we really thought we'd be qualifying and it didn't really make sense. Part of the scoring rubric we've developed is going to kind of crosswalk those elements. So when you're talking about community engagement at a retailer level, it's just going to have a different expectation in our scoring and if you're a direct services provider. But we also recognize in the food desert tax credits, one of the conditions we put in place for the retailers is that they have community listening sessions, particularly because of the concerns we've heard around food quality, that there are those resources in some of the supermarkets and some of the food deserts, but the produce is rotten and the cans are expired. So that's the kind of community engagement I think we'd be looking for. Also, the reality is that I think some of these retailers, in order to come into Atlantic City, they're going to need to understand that's what people actually want, because right now the market isn't bearing what we want, and so it's sort of facilitating that lower case key engagement.
Yeah, and I guess I agree with all that. I guess I'm just, that feels more like engagement going forward versus demonstrate that you have a past track record into it. So.
It's a great question. I think the other side of it, though, is that we are trying to also dedicate resources to organizations that can be the hosts or facilitators of this, and so having them have a track record of trust and connection within the community, we want to reward that, essentially. But on the retailer side, I think we're going to try and compare like for like when we get a score. And this will be competitively scored on a rolling basis for a period of time, and then if we have more requests than we have funding for, I think we'll revisit what our options are. Yeah, we're trying to cram a lot into here, and that's what you're going to catch.
Sorry, I'm just talking to you. My grandfather ran community chest, I got on the Alka board, and my parents live in the food desert, so I'm thrilled about this. I'm not recusing myself. But real quick, just a period of the map. What is that part that's cut out of that map?
Yeah, so in the food desert community designation, which the board approved about 18 months ago, as you mentioned, the Atlantic City, the contiguous designation of Atlantic City is part of that. So the park that's carved out, I believe, part of the entirety of the municipality of Atlantic City. Most of our food deserts are only part because the analysis is not at the blockers level, but in Atlantic City it's every blocker. So I think that what you're seeing is the carve out of that, but I have to see it.
It's back up, no matter what. And then also, so the other point here was just that Atlantic City, so that means Atlantic City and the Becker part, right?
There's a contiguous, because we built the food desert community, and, you know, the boundaries don't start or end, but the priority in, especially because we're the flying share of this money is coming from an Atlantic City allocation, really important to Atlantic City. Is that we're utilizing the food desert designation, thankfully, based on Gabriel's wise counsel to justify why we're doing this in Atlantic City and not some of the other reasons. So we're trying to walk a lot of lines here.
And lastly, is there any involvement for farm agriculture?
Yeah, so we have been in conversations with the food security advocate who has the Department of Agriculture. One of the areas we're hoping this will facilitate is better connections between farmers and the Atlantic City community. So it could be something that you could pay, a farmer could buy a van where they bring their produce into Atlantic City, and then you get into where are they putting it? Does the place they're putting it have a track record with succeeding? And again, there's a lot of technicality between a smart agriculture and farmer human services around utilization of nutrition benefits at farmers markets, and that's some of what we are hoping to pay for to alleviate and facilitate some of that in bigger uptake. Because that's where you have, like, that people could pay for it, but the system isn't set up to allow them to pay for it. So yeah, that's definitely an area of focus.
Awesome. Somewhere next to the where we can build your rooms.
Good idea. Any other comments, questions?
Hey, just okay. Want to take the opportunity to thank Tim and the entire team at EDA again for all the great work on this. We really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks, Aaron.
Okay.
Motion to approve, Angela. I think it was probably the luck
of the any second? Some second, please.
Joel, second.
Thank you. Any further
coming soon?
Yes.
Any further comments? Questions? Yes. Can we hear a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? All right, hearing none.
Thank you.
Next on community development, Maggie's going to give a presentation on the recommendation for additional funding to support temporary staff for the Main Street Recovery Pickup Experience.
Good morning. Thank you. Staff is requesting the utilization of an additional $1 million of funding from the Main Street Recovery Finance Program to cover costs to maintain the existing temporary staff provided by 22nd Century Technologies, so we can continue to process applications from the Small Business Improvement Grant as well as the Small Business Wage Grant for another 12 months if needed. Our current funding for the temporary staff will be exhausted around the first week of November. We have approximately 780 applications currently under review for the Small Business Improvement Grant. We decision anywhere between 25 and 35 applications a week, and we receive about the same amount every week in new applications as well. So we currently have 15 temps servicing both products, the Small Business Improvement Grant and the Small Business Lease Grant. So we hope not to use this full funding amount, but it will allow us to continue to service the applications without any pause. I'm happy to take questions.
Just to address a couple questions that came up during committee, not about this program particularly, which is great, but temps broadly speaking. One, can you use temps? We sort of don't have a ton of choice, just given the volume of programs we're trying to administer efficiently. Two, temps have been a great hiring pipeline for us. We've hired a ton of great people, probably in the 40s or 50s, Chris, 50s of people have joined full-time. And then I'll still be here, but 50 years of people have come in through the sort of the full-time door, which has been a great talent pipeline for us. Three, Temp World and unemployment levels where we're at, and a really strong hiring market. Temp workers are harder to come by than they were in, you know, 2020. And so eventually the music stops here on how long we can kind of utilize temps at this level, but hopefully kind of advertising or trading that down over time. But the Main Street workers are high volume, turn around the meeting. That's my recommendation.
Any questions? Hearing none, can I hear a motion to approve?
Motion to approve, questions.
Thank you. Second?
Just second.
Excellent. Any further questions? Hearing none, can I hear a vote to approve? Signify by saying aye. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposals, refusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Ginny, you want to give a quick Incentive Committee report?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. EDA Incentive Committee met on September 27th, and the staff presented two Aspire programs for consideration. One is located in Newark, Essex County, and the other in Washington Township in Gloucester. We also presented a couple FYI items, which is including the draft of the committee charter for Incentives Committee. So that's it for now.
Thank you, Ginny. All right, so we're going to go through the items. First is Aspire, and Deirdre is going to present on the Forest Hill House Preservation Urban Renewal Request.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. We are seeking your approval for up to $8,186,785 in Aspire tax credits for a residential 55 and over age-restricted 100% affordable housing project in New York. The project is situated at 505 Mount Prospect Avenue and is known as Forest Hill House. It is also about 7 blocks east of Branchburg Park. The applicant is proposing the rehabilitation of an existing 10-story, 100 residential unit, age-restricted building that encompasses 85,145 square feet. The project consists of 18 studios, 81 one-bedroom, and 1 two-bedroom superintendent's unit. The building has multiple common area spaces and a resident community room on the first floor with 25 parking spaces reserved for building residents. Rents are subsidized and are set for income levels at or below 60% of the area's median income range. The applicant has entered into an assignment of agreement with a previous purchaser for an agreement of sale with the current owner and received an extension of the agreement of sale with a closing date of no later than February 29, 2024. The applicant is currently owned by multiple affiliates of the lead development entity, Treadway Group, LLC, who along with a Treadway affiliate owns 50% of the management member of the applicant. As is the case with many transactions that contain an allocation of low-income housing tax credits, there will be an investor member who will replace Treadway Acquisitions, LLC, as a 99.991% limited partner, with the managing member remaining the same. The co-applicant is AHI Forest Hill House NP, LLC, an entity wholly owned by Affordable Housing Institute, Inc., which is a nonprofit 501c3 entity. AHI Forest Hill House NP, LLC will be providing services and programs to the residents as per the program rules and meets the eligibility guidelines to be the co-applicant. The guidelines are noted in the board memo within your meeting packet. The board memo also gives more information about these programs as well as the scope of the large-scale rehabilitation and overhaul of the existing property. The total development budget is $40,060,258. To help advise the award, we exclude costs that are prohibited by statute and program rules. The total eligible project cost is $33,604,316. The developer must contribute 20% equity in this case, roughly $8,012,052. The equity in this project, when accounting for the life test, for the proceeds, as well as the deferred developer fee, far exceeds that number at roughly $16,122,796. The sources table in the memo shows that there are sources of debt besides the that are mentioned for the project financing and the deal. We subject the applicant's request to the program's various award tasks. In this case, the project is eligible to receive up to 60% of total eligible costs or $90 million, whichever is less. However, the award is also subject to a cap of 90% of total eligible costs when factoring in the life test. In this case, the calculation would result in a lower number, and the award would be capped at $13,958,234, which is 41.54% of the project cost. The calculations are also detailed in the board memo. The applicant has requested an award of $8,186,785. And to further size the award, we looked at the project's rate of return. In this case, we use New Jersey Housing Mortgage Finance Agency for a developer fee model. The total developer fee is $3,360,640, with $1,589,907 deferred and not fully realized until the 7th year of operation. This also conforms to the NJHMSA policy. Based on the aforementioned factors, we are recommending an Aspire award of up to $8,186,785 for board approval. If approved, this project would begin in first quarter of 2024 and be concluded approximately 15 months after start of construction. I'm happy to take any questions you may have at this time.
This is the project where the residents will stay in the buildings, right?
Yes, that is correct.
It'll just be moved around as construction takes place.
Yes, they have plans to have the residents go to the community center for refreshments and things of that nature. They're planning on completing the units in enough time so that residents can go back in the evening.
Go ahead, ask your question.
Yes, and first of all, thank you for doing this. I think affordable housing across the state is critical. My question is one, what percentage discount do you give to make this affordable? You talked about the income level of people eligible to live in a building, but what about the cost of the rent?
So the cost of the rental units are based off of the residents' income level, and in this case, it's 60% of the area median income. And there will be other subsidies that the tenants will be able to receive and are likely getting.
Okay, so not just the income that they have, but also the cost of the unit.
Yeah, it's an oversimplification, but rent-restricted units have a formula that is based on,
I forget, 30% of
the AMI is some number,
right,
30%
okay.
of that is another number, and that's the max monthly rent in that regulated unit.
Okay, thank you.
30%
of annual income
is based off the tenant's annual income. It should not go higher than 30%.
The cost of housing.
Correct. Yes.
That is
where they qualify for subsidies.
Okay.
Out of curiosity, why would the developer not take all of the Aspire award? I think this is the first time I've seen that in one of our Aspire.
Well, that's a question I can't answer.
Yeah, sure. Well, this is what they qualify for.
Yeah.
And sometimes the developer doesn't need the full, whatever they're entitled up to.
Make their math
work. Yes, to make the math work.
There are other sources of funding because it may have been the agent they covered most and they needed this piece of office.
Right, that's the mindset part, yeah.
What's the duration of the term, the eligibility term?
10 years.
For
Aspire Award.
The affordability is 30.
Control of disease restrictions, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, that's 30. Yeah.
Kevin, was that you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to try to help explain the math, but it's the way these affordable projects work is they effectively start with a series of kind of sources, the first one being the permanent mortgage, the next one being the low-income housing tax credit, and then there's a handful of other, like, repeat sources that they use, like the deferred developer fee, and then you're kind of just left with, like, how much more money do you need to cover all of the total development costs, and then it backs into an Aspire number. So in this case, to fund all of their development costs, they didn't need the full Aspire amount. So they just requested the amount that they needed to fill that remaining plug in the sources table.
And those details are in your support number. It's listed and spelled out, including the underwriting
fee. Just a question. I think you were hitting on this before. Because there are improvements in the kitchens and bathrooms across the 100 units, tenants will move out during the day and stay in the community center and then move back into their apartments in the evening?
That's my understanding of how this is going to work, yes.
Not ideal. All right, any other further comments, questions? Hearing none, can I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move Jenny Bell.
Thanks. Second?
Second, Marcia.
Thanks, Marcia. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions?
Thank you.
Hearing none, it passes. And now Renee on Washington Township. Another Aspire program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We are seeking your approval to award up to $12,034,818 in Aspire tax credits to a residential 55 and over 100% affordable housing project in Washington Township. The project is situated at 4500 Black Horse Pike and is known as Birchwood at Washington Township. The applicant is proposing the construction of a complex of three-story buildings totaling 54 units on a vacant lot. The project consists of one and two-bedroom units with rent marketing income levels between 60 and 20% of area median income. The applicant is owned by a combination of entities related to the lead development entity, Hagerman Development Company, LLC, and Wellman Electroworks, which is the founder and principal of the lead development entity, serving as a non-member manager of the applicant's managing member. The co-applicant is Premier Housing Services, Inc., which is a 501c3, and will act as the nonprofit for the project financing and will also provide social services. As per program rules, Premier Housing, Inc. meets the eligibility guidelines to be the co-applicant, and those guidelines are noted in the board memo. The board memo also gives more project details, including the rent for the affordable units and specific breakdown of income affordability levels. The new building will include modern amenities and will comply with HMS 80 and EDA's new building standards. The total development budget is $32,512,256. To help size the award, we exclude costs that are prohibited by statute and program rules. The total eligible project cost is $25,289,142. The developer must contribute at least 20% equity or, in this case, approximately $6.5 million. The equity in this project, when accounting for the LIHTC and deferred developer fees, far exceeds that number at roughly $12.1 million. The sources table in the memo shows there are other sources of debt and public funds in the project. We subject the applicant's request to the program's various award panels. In this case, the project is eligible to receive up to 2% of total eligible cost or $90 million, whichever it is. However, the award is also subject to a cap of 90% of total eligible cost for factoring and the LIHTC award. In this case, that calculation would result in the lower number, and the award would be capped at $12,034,818. This calculation is further detailed in the memo. The applicant has requested an award of the same set amount. To help further size the award, we looked at the project's rate of return. In this case, we use the HMSA's deferred developer fee model. The total developer fee is $3,855,381, with $1,902,188 deferred and not fully realized until after 30 years of operation. This conforms to the HMSA policy. Based on the application factors, we are recommending an award up to $12,034,818 for board approval. If approved, this project will be built and ready for occupancy within 24 months of construction start. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer
any questions. Any questions? Anyone on the phone? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Jimmy Bauer, I'll move it.
Elijah, second.
Thank you, Phil. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Next on clean energy, Olivia will present two items.
Thank you.
We're going to stretch three MOUs in a row here.
All right, so the first one, the first memo I'm presenting is between the EDA, the BPU, and the New Jersey Commission on Science, Innovation, and Technology, and JCSIT. The memo reflects the fourth iteration of these MOUs being done between the three parties. The slide gives a great overview of the last 3 years of MOUs. In summary, the BPU allocates funds to the EDA, and then the EDA allocates the funding to CSIT via another MOU, and the EDA takes an admin fee. This year, 3%. The fourth round of funding, which this memo requests, is $6 million of BPU funds, MOU to the EDA. The EDA will take a 3% admin fee, and then MOU $5.8 million of BPU funds to CSIT. In addition to the $5.8 million, there will be about a $300,000 carryover fund on programs last year to, again, strengthen the clean energy and clean tech ecosystem through CSIT programs like the Clean Tech C-Grant and Clean Tech Orange Voucher program. Both of these MOUs require the EDA and CSIT to engage and update each other quarterly on the status of these programs and initiatives. And in summary, this is now the fourth iteration of these MOUs, expanding the runway again of CSIT's programs to date.
Just for anyone spurring up, the admin fees are not because we're, you know, doing this with the opportunity to take admin fees. CSIT does not have office space, an IT department, lawyers, heating and cooling systems. You know, that covers their costs for essentially being a limited cousin.
Are we the primary funder of CSIT?
The state budget is the primary thing. We're a big funder. The state budget is probably bigger than this total funding, but not by much. State budget is 8.5. Can you help me out?
9.7.
9.7. They got this most recent budget. We're big, but not the majority.
Yeah, we don't know if she's right or not.
I was impressed you knew that on the time.
Well, I'll just stay with the story.
Any questions? Okay, hearing none, we're gonna vote on the first item, I guess. This one?
Yes, but it's both MOUs in this item.
Okay.
Money in, money out.
So could I hear a motion to approve?
So moved, Elijah.
Second.
Angelo.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposals, refusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Okay, next memo I'm presenting, thank you, is seeking board approval for the authority to enter into an MOU with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection to transfer $46 million of EDA's allocation of REGI funding to the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection to fund electric public transportation projects. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or as the chairman said, REGI, is a multi-state cap and trade program which New Jersey re-entered into in January of 2018 through an executive order from Governor Murphy. REGI auction proceeds have allocated over $350 million to New Jersey to date. We have the Global Warming Solutions Fund Act and strategic funding plans that set funding allocations to our three state agencies, the EDA, the BPU, and the DEP, and each agency is required to spend funds within specific program areas. The strategic funding plan for 2020 to 2022 have prioritized funding in catalyzing clean and equitable transportation. A substantial majority of the EDA's funding allocations to date have gone towards NJZIP, which is the New Jersey Zero Emission Incentive Program. To deploy the EDA's existing funding as quickly as possible, a portion of the REGI funding is being requested to be transferred to the DEP for projects ready for immediate use. Supporting the DEP's project will be one of the most effective ways for both parties to accomplish their respective obligations under the active plan. With the $46 million from the EDA, and the DEP is also receiving $24 million from the BPU, the DEP will invest a total of $70 million to fund the purchase of electric vehicles all operating in overburdened communities across the state. Under this MOU, the DEP will be solely responsible for administering the project funds, ensuring that the project continues to satisfy the EDA's mandates under the active plan. And in conclusion, this funding builds on more than $250 million already awarded statewide since 2019, funding nearly 3,000 electric vehicle charging stations, 700 electric trucks, and 12,000 electric passenger vehicles. Thank you. Any questions?
Satisfied, but maybe a curiosity. Given particularly the dynamic of things you saw we have going on earlier, every now and again we have an opportunity to wholesale fund some things, put some money to work with partners. So, ready to modify to continue to replenish at a pretty high rate given the success of this auction. We all know Reggie does. And so a chance to move some money in bulk and put the money to work quickly and get partners to take the home for it.
Pretty staggering how much capital we've been able to deploy this.
Yep.
Any questions, comments? Hearing none, can I hear a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Thank you. A second?
Jimmy Bella.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Wind, Ida?
Good afternoon, everybody. Before you use an MOU between
the... She's right, it's 1201, she's right.
NJBTU and EDA for BPU to provide $10 million in funding to the EDA for wind energy-related programs. This is the fourth MOU of its kind in which EDA and BPU have entered into such an agreement. Over the last 3 years, BPU provided NJEDA with a total of $21.5 million in funding. With that funding, the EDA has advanced several initiatives in ultra-wind workforce training, education, research, and innovation. These programs include awarding and running grant challenges that have resulted in ultra-wind training programs, expanding training programs for secondary and post-secondary students for high-demand positions in component manufacturing, establishing a wind fellowship program with 8 universities, as well as several other initiatives. The $10 million in this MOU will support continued development and execution of offshore wind workforce and education programs, initiatives to advance offshore wind learning, research, and thought leadership at New Jersey universities, development and execution of initiatives that spearhead research and innovation to unlock market potential and or specifically address challenges facing New Jersey's offshore wind industry. The MOU includes a cap of $300,000 equal to 3% for administrative expenses tied to the implementation of programs that require assistance from EDA departments outside of the offshore wind team. The MOU has a term of 5 years and includes requirements for the EDA staff to continue to engage with and provide BPU staff with quarterly updates on the status of these programs and initiatives. In summary, the board is asked to approve entering into this MOU with BPU for BPU to provide EDA with $10 million in funding to support Wind Institute-related programs for offshore wind workforce development, education, research, and innovation initiatives. I'm happy to answer any questions.
So again, this is incoming from the BPU to the EDA of $10 million that we then redistribute.
Yes.
We'll come back for those specific redistributions. Submissions for both centers.
So is it from BPU or from us?
This money is inbound from BPU to us. And then we will...
So we're just the conduit?
Not necessarily. So we'll take money in now here. That'll be in our account. And we'll come back to this board to propose how we will deploy it through most of the overwhelmingly the Wind Institute that program that is referring to.
I do. So we're a conduit with discretion.
Correct. And since we're a conduit for a lot of things we get appropriate, we'll be running these machines.
Right.
As opposed to sending it to the CSIT or sending it to the EP or we'll be running those grant programs. Those grant and other programs.
Any comments, questions? Hearing none, motion to approve.
So motion to approve.
Thank you. Second?
I'll second.
Let Marcia.
Let Marcia.
All right.
I'll
any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? Okay. Hearing none, the motion passes. We've got two remaining votes. One is on loans, grants, and guarantees. Michael is on the phone, I believe.
And board members. So under DEP's Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund program, we have 2 municipal grant applications seeking approval for funding. Both of these applications exceed the delegated authority approval of $1.5 million. The first grant request is from the Camden Redevelopment Agency in the amount of $1,967,982 at a project site called the Judge Johnson Park. The proceeds of this request will be used to fund remedial action activities at the project site. And upon completion of full site remediation, the property will be developed at the recreational park facility. The second request is a supplemental grant from the Township of Hamilton in the amount of 937,000 $141 at a project site called the Hamilton Sanitary Landfill. Total grant funding to the township for this specific project is approximately $4.9 million. The proceeds of this request will also be used to fund remedial action activities at the project site. And upon completion of site remediation activities, this property will be redeveloped for renewable energy generation. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes.
Just real quick about the meeting. Fred, do you want to are you on the horn?
No.
No, for the time.
Okay. Fred,
of course,
for the township, right? Lastly, Monica, on authority matters.
Good afternoon. Members are asked to approve written policies and procedures to comply with the requirements of SEC Rule 15C212 and the relevant continuing disclosure agreements executed by the authority pursuant to that rule, and also to delegate authority to the CEO to amend and supplement those written policies and procedures as necessary and appropriate. This request comes out of obligations the EDA has in connection with the HELIX project. By way of a little bit of background, the EDA is a core partner in the HELIX project. Portion of the cost of the project is being financed through the issuance of bonds by the Middlesex County Improvement Authority, which are paid by allocating debt service proportionally as a basic rent from the core partners. In connection with the closing of the HELIX deal in July of 23, we executed a continuing disclosure agreement for the benefit of the holders of the bond. Pursuant to which the authority agreed to comply with certain disclosure requirements and SEC Rule 15C212. In order to comply with those requirements, we committed to creating procedures for identifying the incurrence of material financial obligations or the occurrence of any event reflecting financial difficulties and reporting them. We're also required to provide an annual reporting, which was already filed last month. Staff worked with Bond Counsel and the Office of the Attorney General of the Law to draft these written procedures and policies, and the board is requested to approve them today. Members are also asked to delegate authority to the CEO to amend and supplement those processes and procedures as necessary.
Okay, this is by virtue of the function that we now have for participating in a project that has public funds. So that SEC in
everyone is, of course, the details of SEC Rule 15C. Something after 12, there will be a quiz. You can't take your car out of the parking lot unless you can pass it.
Any questions? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Motion to approve, my
second.
Second, thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any proposal, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Tim?
One delegated memo in your pack about a Premier Lender loan. No need to go into great detail between given the hour. Great, good, sir.
Are we done? Can I just
ask? Public comments.
So let me go first. Yeah. So I'm going to take my EDA hat off, and as my chief of staff in Essex County, on behalf of the county executive and our 22 mayors, we want to thank you very much for coming to Essex County. And before everyone leaves, please stop at one of the great restaurants in the Ironbound, Noel Bloomfield Avenue. Enjoy one of our 22 great parks, the best park system in the state of New Jersey, and stop at the Newark Museum. Any staff, I'm sure Tim will give you an extra hour to get back to eat or to enjoy those amenities. So, thank you very much for coming to Essex. We hope to have you back.
Putting Essex County first, always.
All right, public comment?
We don't have anybody signed up. I'll just go ahead and go over the public comment policy for anybody who needs to provide public comment.
Can I suggest that in the interest of time, we just go to the phone and if there's an issue, if we have anybody.
Great. Sunday, is there anybody? Can you provide the instructions for anybody on the phone to provide public comment, please?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, for members of the public on the phone, if you wish to ask a question, please press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, you may press 1, then 0 at this time. One moment, please. And we have no one queuing up for questions. You may continue.
Nobody has been signed up for questions here. We don't
have any members of the last call for comments. Chris Flores,
you want to say? If there are no additional comments, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation. Now, will we entertain a motion to adjourn the meeting?
I'm going to adjourn.
Anyone opposed? All right, the motion passes. Thank you, everyone, and I agree with Phil. It's great being here, and again, we hope to do this in Camden and Atlantic City. So, thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T conferencing service. You may now disconnect.
Yeah.